From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Florida ranks 49th in the nation in per capita funding for mental health services. We listen back to a conversation on WUSF's Florida Matters from earlier this year about mental health services in the Sunshine State and how current access to care impacts Florida law enforcement agencies, the Department of Children and Families, and other child welfare organizations. Plus, in a surprise move on Tuesday, Florida House Speaker Steve Crisafulli adjourned the chamber 3 days prior to the scheduled end of the legislative session over a budget impasse with the Senate. At the heart of the stalemate is House members' opposition to expanding Medicaid, which senators had hoped would lead to an extension of a federal program providing funds for hospitals who provide indigent care. We explore the impact on health care providers here in Southwest Florida and how local hospitals plan to cope financially. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. In a move that even caught some lawmakers by surprise, on Tuesday, Florida House Speaker Steve Crisafulli abruptly adjourned the House 3 days ahead of the scheduled end of the state's legislative session, May 1st. Crisafulli says he adjourned the House early over a budget stalemate with the Senate. At the heart of that impasse is health care funding and whether or not to expand Medicaid to some 800,000 additional Floridians through the Affordable Care Act. Those affected would be residents who currently earn too much to qualify for Medicaid, but who earn too little to qualify for subsidies for health coverage through the Affordable Care Act. The Senate had proposed an expansion plan that would eventually privatize Medicaid. The state's chief economist, Amy Baker, says her analysis of the proposal shows that it could become a revenue generator for the state over time. Still, the House has remained opposed to Medicaid expansion, and also at stake is billions in federal dollars to support hospitals providing care for low-income patients through the Low-Income Pool, or LIP, program. That funding is set to expire in June. The Obama administration has signaled that without an approved Medicaid expansion plan, extension of the LIP program is unlikely. On Tuesday also, Governor Rick Scott filed a lawsuit against the federal government over the expiration of LIP funding, saying the program's expiration is illegally being used to coerce Florida lawmakers to expand Medicaid. Now, Florida lawmakers will have to come back to Tallahassee for a special legislative session to hammer out a budget. But in the meantime, what does this mean for local health care providers? How will current state government action or inaction impact their future operations and funding? And how are hospitals planning financially in the face of so many unknowns? Joining me now for a closer look is Dr. Alan Weiss. He's president and CEO of Naples Community Healthcare System in Collier County. Dr. Weiss, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. That was an excellent summary.
Oh, good. And we're also speaking with Lee Memorial Health System president and CEO Jim Nathan. Good to speak with you again, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, and thanks for hosting this and inviting us. Your opening summary was right on the money.
All right. Well, combined NCH and LMHS see more than 102,000 patients in their hospitals each year here in Southwest Florida. I invite listeners to join the conversation. You can connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or join the live Twitter chat using hashtag GulfCoastLive. And as I previously mentioned, yesterday's early adjournment of the House caught even lawmakers by surprise. But do you think lawmakers having stayed on for another 3 days would really have had much of an impact in terms of the House and Senate reaching a deal on Medicaid expansion or negotiations with the federal government over the low-income pool? And Dr. Weiss, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it was a famous quote that no one's safe when Congress is in session, so maybe we're better off when Congress is out of session. I don't know exactly. But having said that, I don't know that 3 more days now was going to make a difference. Sadly, I think there's just a polarization between the Florida House, the Florida Senate, that is not productive for either of those parties, nor for, most importantly, the 4 million Floridians who currently have no insurance or are underinsured, particularly when we have the ability as a state to be like 28 other states that have taken the Medicaid money from the federal government. And it amounts to about $5 billion a year for the next 8 years. We've already passed up 2 years. You know, one of the criticisms is it'll only be 80%, or it'll go down to 90% in the future, so it'll be a little bit less than the $5 billion. But having said that, when you look at overall quality and the map of the United States versus the states that are taking the money, the states that typically have been taking the money have better objective quality overall for the health and health care in their state than that the remaining 22 states or so that have not taken the money.
Additionally, do you think there's some sort of disservice being done to residents in places that haven't taken the money, given that it's federal dollars and we all pay federal income taxes?
Yeah, I absolutely. We're paying in, and we're not getting our fair share, and that's the problem. Now, one of the things that the Senate has come up with, and I think most people agree with, you want to have people who are working, who are in that gap, and you described beautifully, where they have too much income for regular Medicaid, but not enough to get the supplement. They're in this awkward stage between about 100% of poverty and 138% of poverty. So it's that group of 800,000 folks who we could get insured. They would be healthier. They would be more productive. It would be just better for the system. And the rest of the folks who are currently buying insurance would see a slight decrease in the cost of their insurance as these 800,000 folks got health insurance, which is distributed equitably. What happens now is the insured people are paying for the uninsured people. It's a little like Robin Hood.
Well, now what happens in Tallahassee going forward? I know lawmakers are looking to reconvene in June to pass a budget. But Jim Nathan, do you have any hopes that the Senate's proposed Medicaid expansion plan that Dr. Weiss was just talking about will be part of those negotiations, or do you think that's just dead, at least for this year?
No, it can't be dead because there's just such a significant impasse. You asked initially the question of, what happens with the abrupt closure of the House. There wouldn't have been a resolution in the next 3 days on this issue, but there were other bills and other things that people had worked hard on, both in the House and the Senate, that now disappear, because when they come back, the focus will be on closing out the budget and so many of those things that people in other areas and other sectors have worked hard on may not get resolved. But the big issue here is Florida is the second highest uninsured state in the nation. And Southwest Florida, where we live, is the second highest region in the state for uninsured after Miami-Dade. We're a small employer economy. We are basically a government-dependent economy because we are so heavily weighted towards Medicare and Medicaid and uninsured and not a large number of major employers. In other parts of the state, Jacksonville or Tampa, Orlando, et cetera, you've got many major employers that are also helping to subsidize, as Dr. Weiss mentioned, that there's this hidden tax that goes to the corporations. Here, it's a small number of medium-sized corporations trying to provide health insurance for their people that are also paying a hidden tax. So there's a whole business case around wanting to get these individuals covered. Besides the fact that it's the right thing to do for them, it also is harming the economics of our state. And in your opening comments, John, you mentioned about the state's economists saying that there's job opportunities to be created. Well, she also took the position the loss of this revenue has the potential of significant loss of jobs, not just in healthcare, but the spillover of other families that relate to the businesses that healthcare helps to bring to our communities. Because in Florida and our aged population, and especially Southwest Florida, our healthcare organizations are among the largest of employers and employment. So that reduction in reimbursement has the potential, according to the state's own economists, in driving people out of the state. So in summary, being the second highest uninsured state in the nation says we need to be focused on public policy that deals with that. The Florida Senate has taken a position, as a number of other conservative states have taken, is this is our money, bring it back, let's repackage it into more of a business-oriented conservative approach, which is the Senate's approach, and let's use it effectively to get these people covered and not have people have to go camp out in emergency rooms to get access to care. And to make sure that Florida's money stays in Florida and doesn't go to Washington and get lost.
Jim, I'm glad you brought up those comments that I mentioned earlier regarding Amy Baker, the state's chief economist, and her economic projections. I wanted to play a short clip of her recent testimony, and this was before a Medicaid workshop for senators back on April 21st. Let's hear that.
The jobs lost are about 20,000 jobs if you shock the economy with this kind of change. And those 20,000 jobs is actually a net number. So there's a lot going on behind it. You're losing from the hospital industry everything from doctors, nurses, surgeons, to the people who work in the cafeteria, to the people who work in the laundry. So it's a broad mix of people in the hospital setting. But you're also impacting everybody who supports that industry. So if they have a contracted laundry service or are buying surgical supplies for someone, they feel some of this impact too. So when we say that roughly the impact would be to lose about 20,000 jobs over this five-year period, we're talking about all through the economy, everyone who supports that as changes are being made. And then in addition, on the last block, you see out-migration. We assume as a result of all this shifting and running it through our statewide model, you're going to lose about 50,000 people from Florida's population. That's coming from kind of breaking up the jobs that are being impacted. One set of jobs are very high level. They're surgeons. They're, people who are very specialized professional physicians, and those people tend to look at the marketplace for where they would find a job as being nationwide. That's their marketplace. So if they're dislocated from a job in Florida, they're not going to look necessarily for another job in Florida. They're going to look for their next best alternative solution to that, and that could very well be for that group outside the state, because that's the marketplace they look at. The ones that probably won't move are the lower level jobs that have other alternatives. So if you're working as a cook in the cafeteria in a hospital and you ended up losing your job or your hours, you can find other alternatives very easily in Florida. It's those high-level jobs that would be most at risk for leaving the state and leaving with their families.
And Jim, I wanted to get your reaction there as that relates to the comments you had just made earlier. Amy Baker is talking about, you know, even population losses. And, you know, these are people with those highly skilled jobs like physicians, surgeons, you know, saying that, you know, their potential pool of where they might get a new job isn't limited to one area or one state. They're looking anywhere they can find one.
This is so big that it's being looked at across the nation. Florida is in the eye of so many. Already, we just got our updated bond ratings from Standard & Poor's and Moody's just this week, and they're watching us very carefully. They gave us a stable rating on where we are today, but they also held it in abeyance, wondering what's going to happen with this funding. We have physicians that are asking the question as we try to recruit them to come to this community, will the revenue stream be there? We have projects and growth. We have a massive, rapidly growing area that is very much dependent upon healthcare services. And I think to not listen to the state's own economist is really wrong on behalf of our legislature. She spoke very strongly and eloquently, as you just played on that. And also the feds a year ago required Florida to get an outside review on all the various forms of funding and tax revenue and Medicaid reimbursement that goes on within the state, and do an analysis of that. And that independent external review came back and said basically what the state's economist said, was we need both of these programs. We need the low-income pool that's currently being funded that won't be after June 30th if the state and the feds can't come together on this. And on top of that, we need to leverage our money back through these expansion dollars. And so you've got two major parties, the state's own economist and an outside consulting firm that understands all these complex formulas of reimbursement, both strongly stating that. And then you have the business community, from the chambers to the associated industries, the clergy community, and others throughout the state stepping forward and saying clearly, this is the right thing to do for the people here. There's a business case for it, and there's a human case for it. It just makes no sense to be at this impasse.
I wanted to get into maybe some of the specifics of just how significant low-income pool funding has been. You know, as LMHS is one of the largest public not-for-profit health systems in the state that receives no direct tax support, has LMHS historically received a significant portion of LIP funding?
Our net funding from the low-income pool is $48 million a year for our health system, and that is all right now in jeopardy to disappear 100% as of June the 30th. And how we get that, the state does not put any money in. We actually put money into a bucket that goes to the state, and the state pretends that it's state money to leverage federal dollars back. So those dollars wouldn't even be coming back if we didn't fund it. Some other communities that have local tax support for their public institutions use that local public tax money, and so they use that to leverage the federal dollars back. But in our case, we're using our own revenue stream to do that, but that's all in jeopardy. And even though the state doesn't put a penny into it, it's all in jeopardy because the state can't seem to come to an agreement with the feds over that program.
I remember attending an LMHS board meeting, and this was more than a year ago, and during which the expiration of the LIP program was something that was discussed. So lawmakers have known for quite some time that this program was slated to end in June. Extensions of the program have been made in the past. Do you think Florida lawmakers, you know, maybe simply thought the feds were bluffing about ending the program?
I'll give you my reaction now, and they have his own. When the feds made that very clear statement was near the end of last year's session. It was in April when they said a year from now, basically June 30th of 15, this all dries up. So you finish session, they had a success story where they got an extra year on the low-income pool program so everybody could breathe easily. They're exhausted from the end of the session on that plus other issues. They all go home. Well, then we were in an election season, and so everybody's focused on that. And then the elections are over in November, and then you've got a session coming up in March that's going to start in March just as they're getting committees together. There really wasn't anybody spending time on this whole issue. And really, there could have been a lot of work being done behind the scenes. They said, well, we have to wait for the Navigant report, which was the outside consulting report, before we can do anything. And that didn't come in until right before the session. Mm-hmm. But even once it came in, there were still these hardcore positions on both sides. The real movement occurred in the Senate, not in the House. The House has been opposed to this for the last three sessions. Mm-hmm. But the real movement was the Senate being as strong as they are of saying, the Navigant report is right. Let's do it.
And Dr. Weiss, what about you? Does NCH receive a significant portion of LIP funding?
We get net about $7 million. We've been getting it for the last few years, but not before that. So it's material to us. Having said that, it's an antiquated system originally designed to help hospitals like Jackson Memorial Hospital that has a huge indigent load, help them when they have a bad payer mix. And over the years, it's sort of evolved, but ultimately, I think the federal government has been very fair and very firm saying that this is the end of the LIP money as we know it. Now, they said that last year, and they gave us one more year. I don't think we're going to get another year. At best, they may give us a taper over a couple years. At worst, they'll just go cold turkey and just work out something with some hospital systems that literally will go bankrupt, and they're in indigent areas or areas that have a bad payer mix. So at the Florida Hospital Association, and Jim has been the chairman of that, I'm current chairman, we've spoken about what to do for the other hospitals that are in, you know, very precarious financial condition. And fortunately for Southwest Florida, Lee Memorial is very healthy. We're very healthy as a system, but we still need to be cognizant of what's going on in the state and figure out how best to help everyone. Ultimately, if we have more people who have health insurance, namely Medicaid and commercial insurance, everybody will do better, and it'll be a fair system long term. But to evolve into that, it's going to take some, time, perhaps, and some other changes.
And this question may be a bit tangential, but just in regards to the LIP program itself, is there something inherently inefficient about it? And by that I mean, wouldn't the money be better spent providing health care coverage for low-income residents rather than reimbursing hospitals for treating people who don't have coverage and who are then seeking care in the ER, which, as we know, is the most expensive form of care?
I think that, you know, all of that has to be open for it. The low-income pool program, I think, which is really what Alan was implying, was created as a workaround. The feds have had discretion of working with states to try to assist them in some fashion, and it was really created for that purpose. And now we have before us this opportunity to get insurance coverage through either expanded Medicaid or using those dollars to buy insurance for low-income primarily working individuals. And so there's a good argument there that as we've known the low-income pool, there may be a need for some types of projects and programs to come out of a pool that goes beyond to incentivize hospitals that are providing additional services that many others are not providing. But beyond that, I think that's really what the feds are trying to say, is that, you know, let's work on both together and come up with a game plan. But Florida's saying, we just want what we've been getting and leave us alone. And the feds are saying, no, you have another option out there. Let's work on both. And the Senate, I think, is taking a strong position to follow the consultant report for full funding of both. But that's where there's room for negotiation. But if you're not even negotiating, if you're not even at the table, then you are up for the opportunity that we lose both funding mechanisms, and that would be very serious for Florida.
Well, you know, really looking at them both together is at the heart of the lawsuit against the federal government that Governor Rick Scott filed officially yesterday. But does Governor Scott have a point? Does tying Medicaid expansion and LIP funding together create a case of illegal coercion on the part of the federal government?
That's for the courts to decide. It's pretty easy to give an argument in both directions on that one. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, when you go to court, who knows how many months, years, or decades it may take to sort that one out. Meanwhile, we have real issues for our state. And I go back to my opening comment: we are the second highest uninsured state in the nation. We need to be working on figuring out how to deal with that issue. We have some real opportunities with some Florida money that's going to Washington that we ought to be figuring out how to keep it here.
So you're saying these folks need help now. They're really not in a position to be waiting for litigation to work itself out and negotiations to potentially start up again. Well, we're speaking today with Lee Memorial Health System President CEO Jim Nathan, along with Naples Community Hospital Healthcare System President and CEO Dr. Alan Weiss, for a closer look at how local healthcare systems are coping with the financial unknowns they now face due to uncertainty over Medicaid expansion in Florida. I invite listeners to join our conversation with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or follow the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And there was another scenario that Amy Baker, state's chief economist, explored in her testimony at that Senate workshop about redistributing state revenue to cover the loss of federal LIP funding. Let's hear that now.
Is it worthwhile trying to do something like that from an economic perspective? It turns out that when we model the loss of the federal LIP dollars, it's very concentrated to the hospital industry, clearly. And so that shock is very, very strong against the hospital industry, and it causes big responses in exchange. If you try to replace some of those federal LIP dollars from within the budget, you diffuse some of those effects, because even though you're hitting more people, a greater number of industries, more people losing other kinds of services in order to do this, it is a less of a shock to those greater number of people than it is to the hospital industry if they do it alone. And so that improves some of those losses. They're not as intense as what you saw. Particularly for jobs, you mitigate that. Particularly for the population changes, you mitigate that. So think of it this way. If I said everybody in here needed to give me $1,000 to accomplish a particular purpose, then you all would have to think about your own budget and what you would do with losing $1,000. If instead of saying everybody had to give me $1,000, I said the chairman had to cover out of his own pocket that same amount, his decision-making framework is completely different than if it's dispersed among a broader number of people. So that's what we're talking about. To the extent you replace, you're dispersing that effect a little bit and mitigating it a little bit. You never, ever get back to where you were before, but you do mitigate it.
And Amy Baker had sort of characterized the LIP money coming from the federal government as a helicopter drop, I believe was the term she used, as opposed to just redistributing state dollars that would otherwise be going towards other efforts. What do you two think about using state dollars to shore up losses from the end of the federal LIP program? Is that likely or palatable or even a good idea?
I'm happy to comment.
Sure.
Alan, you want to go? Or?
Either way, you go, Jeff.
The House, following that Amy Baker's presentation, the House the following day actually did offer, as kind of an effort compromise, to put some state general revenue into the pot. And what she's really talking about is that there's an opportunity to improve the overall rate structure for all hospitals and spread the load more evenly. I mentioned earlier that the state, from the low-income pool program, the state doesn't put any money in at present at all, and it all comes from a fairly small number of public institutions using local public money, either tax dollars or, in the case of Lee Memorial, our own in non-Medicare, non-Medicaid revenue stream to leverage some federal dollars back for the low-income pool. So that becomes then very specific primarily to those hospitals that are able to put funds in to the pool. What she's talking about, if the state put its money up, there would be an opportunity to spread it more broadly. And that's really true. The question is, how much will the state put up and how long will they put it up? They say don't trust the federal government, but we've seen over the last few years the state has cut back on Medicaid reimbursement rates tremendously over the last few years, making there an even wider gap between what it costs to provide services for Medicaid patients and what the state actually pays for it. So it's a complicated issue, and I thought my reaction to the House's move is that's a possible discussion. It's not a solution to the whole program, but it could be used for negotiations if parties were willing to negotiate and try to find ways of cobbling different pieces together and be as fair as possible.
All right. And, I also just kind of wanted to know specifically with these financial unknowns that we have right now, how on earth do, administrators at each of your respective healthcare systems plan budgetarily for the future?
Carefully is the quick answer. But there's certainly a profit margin squeeze, if you will, in healthcare. We can't continue to be reimbursed the same way we have been reimbursed in the past. There are inefficiencies in every system, ours included. So we've got to be smarter with our health. We've got to get people healthier and get out of the healthcare business, get into the health business, get out of the repair shop into prevention. Mm-hmm. That's really a huge opportunity for everybody. And the other thing is just to comment on the idea Economically, it makes no sense for to take state dollars and redistribute them, even though the hospitals and healthcare would be getting the money. The money's got to come somewhere. It's like taking money from one pocket, putting it into your other pocket, thinking you've made junk, you've created something. In terms of the economics, that's not adding anything. You get the $5 billion per year from the federal government, Medicaid money, that's additional money to the state, rather than just take state dollars and redistribute it.
I'll add, John, to your initial part of that question on the budgeting challenges. Obviously, it becomes a challenge all the time, but this is something we live with every day. What we did in our organization, and I'm sure because I know NCH has done well, it doesn't happen by accident. The organizations that are doing well, it's because there is something healthy that comes out of economic pressures. If it was all too easy, you wouldn't have any incentive to improve. So being under the gun financially is not necessarily bad. The real issue is how big and how fast, and I think that's what Amy Baker's comments were, that you could wreak havoc by just simply eliminating the low-income pool program, not being able to replace it, and not doing expansion creates unintended consequences, or maybe intended by some throughout the state. But what we have to do is every organization to remain in business has to make sure that you still end up operating profitably. So it means in some cases slowing down capital expenditures, repackaging those expenditures, trying to retool. The healthy part is focusing on quality improvements, operational improvements, using lean technologies to improve processes, improving clinical outcomes, et cetera. And I know that that NCH is heavily focused on that, as are we. And so there's good things that come from it. The bigger issue is how big, how fast. And right now, the funding mechanism for that expansion, that $5 billion a year that we're choosing not to bring back to the state of Florida, is coming partially out of reductions in Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement to hospitals. So we're funding, as well as our high-income individuals and others, sending our money to Washington to pay for this expansion. And the real theory behind it was that hospitals would be happy to have a lower Medicare reimbursement if they knew that their uninsured were going to actually have access to health insurance coverage. But right now we're paying for it, but we're not getting the money back.
Right. As far as the situation that we're in now, it sounds like the picture you painted for me, there are hospitals and other areas of the state that are going to be in a more dire situation. But for the time being, you're not looking at potentially laying off staff or reducing services or anything like that.
We're in a growth mode, big
right.
time. And so it provides actually built-in efficiencies if you because in many cases we can't even keep up with the staffing needs that we have because of the growth. But over time that can take its toll if you're not able to replace buildings, facilities, technology, etc., because of an insufficient capital stream. But none of us are hopefully looking for, I've felt that major layoffs are a failure of leadership to not try and plan ahead.
Right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. But we've been speaking with Dr. Alan Weiss, President and CEO of Naples Community Hospital Healthcare System. Also with Jim Nathan, President and CEO of Lee Memorial Health System. Thank you both for being here with us.
Thank you.
There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers, Richard Chinqui and Luke Martin. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.